welcome to episode 182 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. I am the Solid Monster, and we've got a special treat for you here this week on the show. We actually have a guest waiting on the line, a very special interview. Very excited to introduce this man. He's a man with over 40 years in the wrestling business as an editor, an author, and a photographer who has influenced countless careers and befriended some of the biggest names in the industry. If you're not familiar with his name, I guarantee that you've at least seen his work at one point or another. His new book is called Hot Shots and High Spots, George Napolitano's Amazing Pictorial History of Wrestling's Greatest Stars, which is available right now on Amazon.com and other fine retailers. I got my copy a couple of weeks ago and have been raving about it ever since. And George Napolitano joins us now on the line. George, welcome to the Sound Off.
Thank you very much. Glad to have a chance to talk to you.
Absolutely. Now, you've been a very busy man of late, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, anything. Not a problem at all.
Now, you and I have spoken many times before, but for those who haven't had that luxury, I want to familiarize people with who you are and the role that you've played in wrestling over the years. In your book, which we'll get into here in a little bit, you talk about becoming addicted to pro wrestling in the early 60s. What was it about wrestling that drew you into it, and who were some of your heroes growing up?
Okay, like all kids growing up, it was just something that you watched. It was on television on a Tuesday night, a Wednesday night, Thursday night, 9 o'clock at night, Channel 5 in New York. You can watch it Monday night, Tuesday nights from Sunnyside Gardens. Wednesday, I believe, was from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Thursday was from Capitol Arena, Washington, D.C. And it was just something that you did, something you watched. And actually, it was the late 50s, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62. Those were the years. And you said, who did I like? First thing that comes to mind, the Bastien brothers were a tag team. I loved them against the Graham brothers. It was just something you would watch. And Buddy Rogers back in the day, right then. I mean, I didn't like Buddy Rogers, but you wanted to see him. He was the champion. I liked Bruno Sammartino, which I readily admit in the book. That was my favorite Italian, and that's somebody you liked. And I used to watch him at a place called Rollorama in Brooklyn on 86th Street and 24th Avenue, which is, I believe, now a Rite Aid. They used to have wrestling there just about every month, every 6 weeks.
Actually, you were actually talking to me a couple of days ago about the fact that there used to be a lot of wrestling in the Brooklyn area.
Yes.
Not so much these days, but back then.
Oh, well, then in the 60s, yeah, I used to go to Rollorama. And then the 70s and the 80s, there were shows at least three times a month, two, three times a month, Brooklyn and then Staten Island. Brooklyn at all the different churches, Lady of Guadalupe, Regina Pacis, Seaview Center, and all kinds of centers, Knights of Columbus Halls, Wagner College in Staten Island. It used to be all the time. And at that time, I used to sell the programs at the arenas. I used to write the program, sell the different programs in 8x10 glossy photos, and take pictures and run around and take the pictures.
Now, you actually fell out of wrestling for a while to pursue an interest in music, is that correct?
Well, fell out in that, yeah, you get older, and then all of a sudden it wasn't as popular to me. I played in a band. 1964, you saw the Beatles, and then you wanted to be a band, and you were getting a little older, and you got interested in girls and what have you, and it was just something that, just a natural progression. And today, most of the fans, and I don't want to say most, but a good segment of the fans are junior high school kids, age 12, 13, 14, and for some reason, then they break away, and then they come back later. And that's always been the case, except when the WWE got really popular, and it just got across-the-board interest. But generally, junior high school kids love it, and then older adults, female, male.
And the music thing lasted for a little while.
10 years, at least 10 years.
Wow.
And we recorded for Mercury Records on a label called Smash Records. Smash was a subsidiary of Mercury. Had three songs out, and it was just something I did. And I played into the 70s and 80s, 90s, and whatever. I used to still get together with friends I used to play with. And in fact, next week, I'm playing with two guys from the band, and they want to play again. And I said, I said no. Then I said, yeah, okay, of course. It's just something that you got to do. I haven't done the last couple of years, but it's just something that that always draws me in. And I've written songs for independent films and things like that. I mean, it's just something that I did.
Now, you officially got your start in wrestling in 1970, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about how that came about. You've obviously become famous for your photography, but people may find it interesting that it wasn't necessarily something you envisioned yourself doing right from the onset.
No, I used to have, as I just mentioned previously, I used to watch when I was a youngster. And then in 1970 or so, looking through the paper, I see in Wrestling Tonight, Madison Square Garden, and I go to my girlfriend, who's now married for 40 years, and I said, tonight there's wrestling. You want to go see this? She said, oh, I've never been to wrestling. I said, well, it's at the Garden. I used to go. It used to be nice. And we went, bought a ticket, and we sat in the loge, and it was fun. I took some pictures, and then they announced that next Saturday or so, there's wrestling in Sunnyside Gardens. And I turned to her and I said, I used to go there on a Saturday afternoon. We used to have a good time. She says, well, you want to go? We'll go Saturday. And on Saturday afternoon, I went to the Sunnyside Gardens. Once again, I just brought my camera with me because that was just something I was doing. And I always run down the aisle, took a few pictures, and somebody stopped me and says, oh, you must have to take good pictures. You've got a great camera. I said, yeah, it should be all right. You know? And he says, if you ever come back, bring your photos. And 6 weeks or so later, I went back to Sunnyside Gardens, and I brought some pictures, and the fellow liked the photos and asked me, would you want to work for me? I do stories for Ring Wrestling. I said, yeah, okay. And I didn't know what I was getting into. I said, yeah, okay. And then the following month, I went there with some photos, and he introduced me to Arnold Skolin, who was Bruno Sammartino's manager for many years, Bob Backlund's manager, but he was in charge of the WWWF in the background. He used to be the agent in charge. And,
sure, the Golden Boy.
Yep, Golden Boy, Arnold Skolin. And I knew of him. I remembered his name. I didn't know him. And he introduced me to him, and he says, this is going to be my photographer. And the guy says, yeah, okay, it's good. Yeah, just watch yourself. Stay out of everybody's way. And that's how I started, really, taking pictures. And then what really happened is this fellow who was Spanish heritage, from Spanish descent, gives me his story and says, would you mind bringing this story with you to the, tell me where to go, fellow named Nat Lube at Ring. Ring magazine was a big boxing magazine, and he also did wrestling. He says, would you bring my story and put your pictures with it? And I says, yeah, okay. And I went home and I read the story, and it made no sense. I could not read the story. I couldn't get through it. It just was run-on sentences. I just couldn't read it. And I didn't think of myself as a writer at all. I mean, I hated writing. It just was not something that I liked to do or did. And so I brought the story up to this Nat Lube with my photos. He looked at me, all your pictures are great, He says, oh, and this is one of my best writers. When he said that, I says, oh, I cringed because I felt embarrassed almost to give it to him as if I had done it because I'm handing it to him. I said, well, if you like that, I think maybe if you never need anything, I can do probably maybe almost as good as that. I figured I could do it. If that's what he was accepting, I can do that.
Sure.
I don't think I could do anything more than that. I can do that. He says, oh, well, he's one of my best. I don't know now. I says, just bring anything you want anytime. Just put your pictures with it and you just write it. And that's how I started writing the stories. And I wrote for Ring Wrestling magazine, just about almost every story in that magazine came from myself or this fellow named Tom Burke. And I used to use all kinds of names, just use different names because they wanted to look at Gary. I wrote everything, or Tom too, just to use different names. And that's how I started, really. And then almost seven, 8 years later, I became editor of different magazines. Various magazines.
Well, I was actually going to ask you about that next. You know, when I was a kid, wrestling magazines were a big deal. Certainly a lot bigger than they are today with the proliferation of the internet and wrestling news sites and all that. I get copies of the old WWF magazine each month and thumb through the photos, and the articles actually helped fill in some of the gaps when it came to the stories, and in other cases it helped advance them. Now, you don't really have that today, but back then, there was an abundance of magazines you mentioned. I know that you worked yourself as part of the Starlog series. You had Wrestling Action, Wrestling Scene. just to name a few. How important were wrestling magazines back then? Because I don't think people really realize how important they were.
See, seeing as much TV as you see, and knowing, and getting tapes from all over the world, and knowing all these things, you can't think that there was anything before that. Before that, the only way you ever really knew about a wrestler that you didn't see on TV was through the magazines. Everything, first, wrestling, as I guess most people know, was regional. And in any region, you would just see your guys. You wouldn't see, for instance, if you lived in New York, you wouldn't see who was wrestling per se in Florida, but I'll say you did for a different reason. Or you didn't see who was wrestling in Texas. You didn't see who was wrestling somewhere else. So you just thought what was happening was in your backyard. You didn't know that. And every once in a while, someone else would come in and you would see him. But the magazines were a way for fans to know that it wasn't just where you live. It was all over the country. And there were more wrestlers than you've seen on your TV show. When I used to go, I used to travel a lot, and I would go to Texas, comes to mind, and I would meet the superstar Billy Graham. I said, oh, this guy looks good. Write a story about him, and then all of a sudden, people in New York, in California, in Minnesota, superstar, he looks really good. And then when you've seen him, you already had some knowledge of this person. So it wasn't like he's coming in cold. And Graham then was big, and you would already gravitate to him. But a guy like, say, Tony Garea, who wasn't all that big, you would read about him, and all of a sudden you would watch this new guy that you're seeing. You say, "Oh, I read about him. He must be pretty good." So you watch it with an open mind. And we, myself and a couple other people, paved the way for a lot of these wrestlers then to make names for themselves and able then to move to other territories. They should keep in touch with me because I just wanted, they wanted people to know that they were out there. I mean, Randy Savage, I got a picture of him when he first started, but I met him, and then he kept in touch with me, and he would send me articles from where he was, and every once in a while I would put pictures that he would send me in and put it together with a story so then people would know about these different guys. And this lasted until what I meant is cable TV took over. Probably the last people that became big, and that's not even true, too. I was going to say the last people that came big were the Road Warriors, but that's not even true. But the Road Warriors were an example. Hawk would go around and tell everybody that if it wasn't for me, he says, nobody would have known about us. But that's not true. They would have taken their time. They would have known about him. But
sure.
This translates up into the 90s when the Dudleys were making a name for themselves in ECW. And the only way people really knew about the Dudleys and the people from ECW, which were the magazines. You would see you would look at these magazines and see the pictures that I would take or somebody else would take and read some stories about them. And you say, well, these guys are crazy. They're amazing. So they actually got a following without people actually seeing them.
And it's funny you mentioned that because that was one of my next questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are wrestlers that have credited you. I mean, I remember seeing something, Steve Corino, actually, online. I remember where I saw it, but Steve Corino once made a comment that people like you were kind of the unsung heroes of pro wrestling because the work that you did really played a pivotal role in the careers of getting a lot of wrestlers noticed at a time when perhaps otherwise they would not have been.
Yeah, right, because I used to include everybody in my magazine. Of course, I would write about the top guys and who was ever big, but then I used to do 3, 4, 5, 6 magazines a month. So I couldn't always do the same people over and over again. So I would always include 2-3 stories about somebody that you really didn't know about. And every month there was 2 or 3 in each magazine about all these different people and these different groups. I used to go to all the different shows and write about everybody. And then it's a copycat business. If I did it, the people from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, which were my competitors, would say, how come we don't have these people? And then they would write about them too. It was.
You're actually a contributor now to Pro Wrestling Illustrated, ironically enough.
Yes, I am, and that was my competitor, and I contribute to them. I'll send them photos of the events I still would go to now, but it's so different. I don't feel like I'm involved because I had an involvement where I would write the story and really be there and really have to know what was happening. Where now I just take the pictures and I send them off, and they go their merry way, and then they're just used however people want to use them.
Now, you and I saw each other right after you came back from L.A. for SummerSlam in August. And during our conversation, we were talking, and you mentioned something I was not aware of at the time. You were the one responsible for that iconic image of Andre the Giant posing with four ladies, all of whom were wrestlers, one on each shoulder and one in each arm. In the book, you actually call it the most famous shot you've ever taken. How did that come about, and what sort of relationship, if any, did you have with Andre?
Well, let's see. First of all, Andre, I met him when he was wrestling as Jean Ferrer in Montreal, Canada. He wrestled for a promotion, Grand Prix promotion, run by Butcher Vachon out of Montreal. And it was this big guy named Jean Ferrer. It was Andre the Giant. And he was just amazing. And I would just write some stories about him, and people were getting to know who this Jean Ferrer was. And then when he came to New York through the WWWF, he says, "Oh, boss, I know you, thank you." And he was thanking me for writing story, you know, for letting people know who he was. He was just a really nice guy. And this was probably early on in his career. Vince McMahon Sr. says, I need to take some pictures of Andre. I want to do a picture where he's holding up the girls just to show how big he is. I said, okay. And I took the picture in Philadelphia Arena, and I want to say about 73, 74, 72, 3 or 4, and I don't know exactly.
I think in the book it says 72, I think.
Okay. Well, that's when it was. And aside, yeah, I went and went back and checked on dates on stuff because I've done this so long that everything runs into each other. I don't even remember. But I did check a lot of stuff that you can find online these days. Okay, so about Andre, I went and then I took this photo of him holding these four lady wrestlers who were on the card, Vicki Williams being one. I can't even remember exactly. I got to think about it. But there were four lady wrestlers who were wrestling that day on the show. And Joyce Grable was on the card, who I actually had known, had met before that, and she came a little late, so she lost her spot on Andre's shoulder. And I only say this because I saw her but the last Cauliflower Alley Club convention a couple months ago, last April, and she happened to mention the photo to me. And so I used what she wrote about the photo, that, I remember that I took it. She says, I remember you took it. But people used to see it everywhere. And Andre was the first wrestling superstar, and that he wrestled in every territory. He would go, and Vince McMahon Sr. would book him in every territory as an attraction. So as the attraction, Andre then would go there, but before he would arrive, they would send out the photo and make posters and put up, look, Andre the Giant is coming. They would use that picture as a poster for Andre, that he's coming to their arena. That's why I say it's the most famous that I've taken. I've taken so many, but that was the one that you would see everywhere. In fact, it wound up on menus, and I was in Hollywood even last year somewhere. I went to a restaurant, and it was opening up, and then there's a picture of Andre holding the girls in the menu of the restaurant. I've seen it everywhere. Everywhere you can think of, I've seen that picture.
Now, you've had the chance to travel all over the world. You were invited to tour with, I believe, New Japan Pro Wrestling. You've been over there about 10 times over the course
Correct.
Of your career. You've been to Mexico, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic. I bring this up because in his book, To Be the Man, Ric Flair tells the story of his NWA title match in the Dominican Republic with Jack Veneno, I believe it was.
That's correct.
And he actually name drops you during the story. Apparently, he had no idea who his opponent was going to be, and you call to tell him to look out his hotel window, and there's Veneno jogging around with thousands of people.
Right, trailing behind him. And I was just training. He was showing people, I'm going to train to wrestle this American champion. I'm going to beat him. And his training routine was to jog. He was jogging outside, and there were thousands following him, jogging. He was in the front. And so he looked out the window. I said, Rick, you see that crowd? What's that? I said, that's the guy you're wrestling. He says, what is that? So he was scared. He didn't know what was going to happen.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask you, what was that whole experience like? Because those fans down there were so passionate that it made for a very dangerous environment.
Yes. And during the match, first, you have armed guards with guns, armed guards with guns, and people who are ready to reach at you and blade you at a second's notice. So he tried to stay in the ring, because if he fell out of the ring, he knew he was going to get knifed. So you try to stay in the ring. And then you can feel the intensity in the arena just building, building, building. And really what Rick did is he literally put Jack Veneno on top of him, grabbed him. He says, pin me. He says, no, pin me. And he kept his shoulders to the mat so Jack Veneno could pin him. So now when they announced that he was the winner and new champion, which wasn't going to happen that way, the people went crazy and he just ran right out of the ring. Now, Rick and whoever else, and I really, really don't remember. I know it wasn't the president of the NWA, but somebody to do with the NWA says, you were here, you're the only one here, but this didn't happen, remember? I says, it happened right in front of me. He says, no, you know it didn't happen. I says, Rick lost, right? I says, yeah, he lost. He says, but it didn't happen the way you saw it. I said, okay. Didn't happen the way I saw it. But yes, I wrote about the story in Wrestling Main Event that Jack Veneno pinned Ric Flair, and I had pictures, but I never said that the title changed hands, which the title did change hands. They announced that it did. And then later, I want to say that the NWA record books clarified it and wrote that it was a title change.
So it is official.
I believe, and I'm not going to be 100% sure on this, but there is a, quote, record book, unquote, and I believe it is an official title change. But at the time, it wasn't noted as such, and you didn't hear about it on the TV or anywhere, or NWA, and you didn't read about it in any magazines. There was no internet to let you know that this was happening. The only one there
sure.
to let you know what was happening was me.
I think there was a similar phantom title change. Was it Bob Backlund
and Antonio Inoki? Yes.
Yes.
That never officially came out. But Japan now has and had 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 photographers around ringside. So they couldn't hide it. Couldn't really hide it, but it wasn't really known. But just not known as well as it would have been known in today's day and age.
Sure. Now, what was your relationship with Ric Flair like? Do you still keep in touch with him?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Saw him this past summer at a place you know very well, MCU Park.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm still very friendly with him. I mean, I'm not going to say we talk all the time, but yes, I do talk to him on occasion, and we see him. He hugs me. We talk, and I'm myself and Bill After, I guess, the only ones that know him from his first days wrestling, first wrestling days. I saw him early on in the 70s, 74, 5, and Charlotte, North Carolina, before he had his big plane accident. And you knew he was something special, you know. He was good, and he was nice and friendly. And we were friends then, and we still remain friends. And of all the wrestlers I've seen, which I'm sure you're going to ask me at some point later on, of all the wrestlers I've seen, Ric Flair probably was the best all-around wrestler, bar none. He was number one. Though I was a Bruno Sammartino fan, yes, and I liked Hulk Hogan, but for sheer wrestling skill, entertainment, and everything else that you can put together, Ric Flair was head and shoulders above everybody. But I will say, some people only know him from the last 4 or 5 years, so you can say, now, how can you say that? Well, it's not based on the last 3, 4, 5 years of Ric Flair. It's based on his career.
Of course, his entire body of
yeah.
work. Now, I wanted to ask you about another person, Paul Heyman,
uh-huh.
who some people may not realize got his start in the business as a photographer.
Yes.
And I recall reading an interview that was done with, you mentioned Bill After's name, some time ago, and he was actually asked about Paul. And he talked about being at ringside back in the day with you and other photographers who tried very hard to have Paul banned from ringside because he had this nasty habit of walking in front of you guys while you were shooting. First, is that true? And second, looking back, what are your thoughts on Paul's rise to the ranks?
Okay. First, I will say the book has over 300 pages, has over 400 photos, and somehow, some way, I didn't pick all the pictures. They were sent out, and final selections were made by whatever. There is no picture of Paul Heyman. That is the only one of the few oversights I have in the book. Yes, he should be in there. I do not have a photo of him in the book, and I really, really don't know why. Didn't realize it until later. Okay, now to talk about Paul. He will probably tell you, if you spoke to him, that I was the only person that actually talked to him. The other guys didn't really even want to talk to him. I wanted to have nothing to do with him. Yes, and when you said, get in the way, yes, he did get in the way. I remember that now after when you mentioned that. But I was friendly with him, and he was a younger kid. He was younger than us at the time, and he wanted to get involved in wrestling, and he wanted to be a photographer or whatever, and he went about it like some people go about things when they try to do it and they're young, in a different way, and he was a little pushy, and so that's why they wanted to get him barred, because they didn't like his attitude. Though I was friendly with him in that I would talk to him, and I was probably the only one that actually talked to him. But that being said, he worked very hard to do what he did. He knew he wanted to become a manager, and he went and became a manager. And he moved up. And he worked at it. And aside, Jim Cornette did the same thing in Memphis. He used to write stories and take pictures for wrestling news, but out of the Louisville and Memphis area. That's what he did. And he, as we know, became what he became. I myself, people would say, oh, you should have been manager, you should have did this. I had it in my head a little bit, but at the time I'm so small and I'm looking at all these big guys. I said, I can't do this. This is crazy. I was doing other stuff and I just didn't want to be involved. I said, no, forget it. But looking back then, the Grand Wizard, who was my first friend and was the one who told me, you should be manager. Come on, I'll help you. He was the one who tried to push me, if anybody tried to push me, but he didn't push me to the point of saying, you got to do it. But I just didn't have it in me.
Well, it's. I want to skip ahead here to another question I had. Mm-hmm. It's funny you bring that up. I was going to ask you about an independent angle from 1991. Mm-hmm. Now, you may or may not be aware of this. There's footage on YouTube, pretty rare footage of this angle, involving Ravishing Rick Rude and the Honky Tonk Man, who were arguing over who is the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time. And I'm watching this video, and much to my surprise, there you are on camera, right in the middle of everything. You're interacting with a guy by the name of Tony Rumble. Do you have any memory of this at all? And how often did you appear on camera for something like this? I imagine
okay.
It's pretty rare.
Tony Rumble, rest in peace, was a good, good friend. He worked for something called IWCCW, International World Class Championship Wrestling, run by Mario Savoldi. They used to do tapes in Boston and Massachusetts area and sometimes in New Jersey and what have you. And they would tape the shows and put together a wrestling show, which would then be sold around the world. We would see it occasionally if you were lucky enough. It was on television. It was actually on television. And these tapes would be sold around the world. And as we speak, I am positive there is an IWCCW wrestling show on now somewhere in the world. This is still going on to a much smaller scale, but tapes still being sold. But Tony Rumble was the announcer, and I used to go to their shows, and they used to try to put me on the camera with them and to do some kind of talk, some interview as the matches are happening, as a color commentator of sorts. And every once in a while, he would call me to make prognostication or to talk about what was going on. And that day, they had the Honky Tonk Man and Rick Rude there. He said, I'm going to bring you up. And I had no idea what he was doing, because I never knew what he was going to do. And they had a confrontation. Who was the greatest Intercontinental Champion? And I want to say that though the Honky Tonk Man was the greatest, according to him, I think Rick Rude had more titles, and I think I might have said that.
Well, Rick Rude had more, I guess, titles overall.
Intercontinental, but then he was the Intercontinental Champion, but Rick Rude also had been champion in more places
at that
moment. At that moment. Yeah.
And Honky Tonk Man to this day maintains that he is in fact the greatest intercontinental.
The greatest intercontinental of all time. Yes, he still does.
Exactly. Now, when you did that segment, if you remember much of it, did you have fun doing it?
Oh yes, it was fun. And I used to have my son would come with me too, and he would take pictures. And they liked when I was there because, again, just going back to the magazine bit, people then would see about Vic Steamboat, who was Ricky Steamboat's brother, would read about Vic Steamboat and Joe Savoldi and guys like Tony Rumble and other people who you would never have read about or seen about. I used to write about them in my magazine. And I would, so they were recognized as a promotion of sorts, not major, but people knew who they were because I would put them in the magazine. And they loved when I went there. And they used to go to Kutcher's Country Club, always the holiday. And I used to go with my family to Kutcher's. And my sons would take the pictures, and I would run around and have a good time. And it was run, as I say, by Mario Savoldi, whose father, Angelo Savoldi, I want to say, is 98 years old right now. And he had a long, long career. He worked for the WWWF. And he was an agent like Arnold Skolin back in the day. And then they started running their own shows and their own promotion. That's how that came about.
We talked about Paul Heyman a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
You speak very highly of the original ECW in the new book. What was it about the promotion that made it so special to you?
Because it was different than what I was seeing in WWF and different than what I was seeing in WCW at that time. They were just crazier, wilder. More to what I seen at that time in Puerto Rico, where I used to go forever. I used to go to Puerto Rico. I was the only person that would go to Puerto Rico and go cover their matches. And they would have all these crazy, crazy, crazy bloodbath matches with barbed wire and fire and all kinds of stuff. And I used to go to Texas, and Texas had a little more wilder matches than you would see in the WWWF or WWF setting. So that's what I liked about ECW. The matches were a little wild, a little crazier, and they used guys who were somewhat known, guys who weren't known at all, and they would bring in a name or two. And honestly, it was the name or two that would attract me to go that particular week. But then as you went, I would see guys like Taz, who I kind of knew, and the Dudleys, who I met back in the IWCCW days when they weren't the Dudleys. Other guys that I knew just from going to the matches. And the action that they did was crazy, phenomenal, and weird, just all rolled into one.
I remember back then on locally here on the MSG network. I mean, their TV would come on, I think, at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And on occasion when I was up and I had the chance to watch it again, I was always a kind of a diehard WWF fan growing up.
Yeah.
And the thing that always struck me about it was it just seemed like complete anarchy. Every time you would watch, there was just complete mayhem and carnage, and people were attracted to it because it was so different than what they were seeing week to week on TV.
Right, that's what it was. But that too, now you were talking about watching on TV, and Paul would spend 28 hours of a 24-hour day editing those tapes, cut, and show you highlight, and that's what you were seeing. You were seeing highlight. Their matches would go 20, 30, 40 minutes. And when you saw it on TV, it was 5, 6, 7 minutes. So you can imagine how much was cut out of it. But then put that all together. That's why that tape seemed so crazy. Because you were seeing highlight after highlight after highlight after highlight. And so people who then were only watching on television think it was really insanity. And it was. But it wasn't as crazy. Well, and again, I was going to say something, but maybe not be so true. It was as crazy as you want it to be, but I think the TV presented it even crazier than it was because of all the cuts and the clips.
Now, in the book, you talk about having attended maybe not everyone, but certainly most of the major pro wrestling events over the years, mm-hmm. you were, just to give an example, you were at the very first Starrcade, which I believe was in Greensboro. That was the A Flair for the Gold, AWA Wrestle Rock, the Shea Stadium shows that WWF had back in the day. And very impressive. You apparently never missed a single Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, or Survivor Series show. And this leads into my next question here, which I wanted to ask you. You've obviously been ringside for a lot of the biggest matches in wrestling. And one of those matches was the infamous Survivor Series bout in Montreal between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels.
Okay.
And I bring this up because I'm watching footage of this not too long ago, and there you are on camera at ringside for probably the most famous finish to a match in modern history. And I've always been curious to get your insight into this. You're watching all of this unfold, and I'm sure that at the time you were aware of all the rumors heading into the match. What was the atmosphere like at the building that night? And take me through what's going through your mind at the end of that match.
Okay. The last thing you said was everything that was leading up to it and you kind of knew what was going on. No, first of all, I don't think anybody knew what was going on. Or what would go on. It was...
more in terms of like the bad blood that existed.
Yeah.
It was clearly, even if you watched on television every week, you knew that Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels were two guys that probably didn't really like each other in real life. I think that came across on TV.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it did. And we were in Montreal, the home of Canada or whatever. I want to say the home of Bret Hart, but no, he was from Calgary. But Canada being what it is, he was Canadian. He was a local hero against some, who knows what, an outcast. As this is going on, I'm just focused on what I'm seeing unfold in front of me. But you got to understand something. I'm looking at every match. If you hold your finger to your thumb and make a circle, I'm looking at every match through that little hole. Understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
I can't get involved or know what's really, really going on around me because I'm waiting for what's going on, looking through a little hole in the camera, looking through the viewfinder, actually, looking through the little hole. I'm oblivious to everything that's around me, so I don't actually see everything. If you're sitting there in the arena, you're seeing more than I'm actually seeing. Because I got to look through that little hole and worry about the cameraman who's over my shoulder, worry about the other photographer who's going to run in the way of my picture, a la Paul Heyman. But I have to be aware of everything around me, and it's not easy. So as I'm watching this, I'm not sure what's really, really happening. And as far as the fast count, and I still, to this day, can't really say that I know exactly what went on. All I know is that after it was over, there was mayhem in the back, just confusion, people screaming, wrestlers wanted to quit. There was just a whole breakdown, which has never happened before, and I don't think it's happened since. It just seemed like there was a whole breakdown. Guys were going to quit from what happened, and it was just a whole big thing that they never expected to be. But I will add to this. Bret Hart had cameras going on throughout this whole thing. It's always been my knowledge that Vince McMahon would never let anyone else tape except his own TV cameras. Yes, Bret had cameras going on, but I still maintain to this day they knew what they were doing. That's all I say. They knew what they were doing.
It's not the first time I've heard that. I mean, what you're referencing, Bret was actually filming a documentary that was that Hitman Hart Wrestling with Shadows thing, which came out later on.
Right.
And it is kind of odd that, you know, it just so happened that at that particular time when all this went down, that he would have a camera in the locker room, for example, after the
which,
show.
Which they will never never let outside cameras in this.
Oh,
unless
no.
It's just so. So the whole thing to me, wrestling, they say, is a work. Well, the whole thing to me was a work. I don't know if it was. I'm not exactly sure. I don't think anybody really knows. Whoever tells you they know doesn't really know. And this can, you can say this about everything. Whoever people say, oh, I know, they don't know. They really, really don't know. The only one that knows is the ones who are really involved.
Now, let's say someone listening to this right now wanted to break into the wrestling business, not as a performer, but as a photographer. They have a genuine passion for photography, or maybe they just want to use it as a way to get their foot in the door to do other things. How different are things today relative to the way they were when you first started? And would it be more or less difficult, in your view, for somebody to break in the same way?
Well, see, it's a whole different thing right now. It's so fragmented. It's WWE or nothing, okay? Yes, TNA, but it's them or nothing. But then on the other hand, you have all of these smaller groups, and I will say that last night, somehow I found some site. I found a site. I don't know where it came from, and all of a sudden I see dates. If you went to today's date, I was shocked at the number of wrestling shows that are happening tomorrow night. There's got to be like 20, 30 shows. I mean, I was floored because I don't follow it as much. I mean, I just don't know that. I was stunned how many shows are going on. And this is what's happening in Jersey and in Staten Island and wherever. You had asked me that about early. They know there's so many shows. There's still a lot of shows. But today, what is it that somebody would want to do? I mean, if there are just so many different fringe groups that if you're really interested in getting to something, you don't have to be a cameraman at ringside to get you work your way into the back, so to say. You just show up, go, and eventually you'll meet somebody. If you're that enthused, you will meet somebody who will then lead you to the next person who will then lead you to that person who might help you do whatever. That being said, are all these people legitimate? I don't know. It's a crapshoot. I don't know.
The other big difference, or one big difference, I should say, which you had mentioned to me when you got back from SummerSlam, and it's obvious to anybody who's been watching wrestling for any length of time, is how the photographers are no longer located at ringside for the television shows. Mm-hmm. I remember you telling me you still are for the house shows, but not for the TVs. Now, you guys are pretty much, you were moved over, I believe, to an area next to the hard camera, and this started right around the time WWE transitioned over to HD in, I want to say, 2008. How has this changed how you go about doing your job?
It's a lot easier. Much easier.
Really?
Oh, please. No, okay. For me today, it's much easier. But if I was really doing the magazine the way I used to do my magazines, I would want to be there, right there, up front, into it, and getting every little angle. For me now, I just sit back. I'm next to the hard camera. I'm looking at the ring in front of me, but I don't have to be staring through that little hole all the time. I look around. I take in the arena. I see what's going on around me, because I don't have to get every shot. I'm not getting every shot. I'm just taking whatever I get, and the pictures are being sent to Pro Wrestling Illustrated, more or less, and that's it. I mean, it's easier. I don't have to get up and down on my knees. I don't have to worry about who's going to run into me. I don't have to worry about who's going to get in my way. Yes, I'll get people in my way, and I'll just, because I'm in this set location, somebody could stand up. But we do have a clear shot, but the referee could run in, or this guy could get in the way, or whatever.
Sure.
It is so much easier.
It takes me back to WrestleMania 11, actually. It's funny you mentioned that, because it was a championship match. It was Diesel and Shawn Michaels, and mm-hmm. they had a ton of paparazzi and extra photographers there that night, because that was the night Lawrence Taylor was wrestling.
Okay.
And as I recall, it was in Hartford, and they had a bunch of different celebrities on the show. And I remember early on in the match with Shawn Michaels, I think Nash sent him into the corner. He went flying over the top rope and actually landed on top of a Japanese photographer, and he manhandled the poor guy afterwards. I mean, he just took out all his frustrations on this camera guy. So you make a good point.
Jimmy
that,
Suzuki, by the
longer...
way.
Oh, is that who it was?
Yes. Okay.
So you're no longer in the line of fire. That's the point I was
trying to say. Yes, but it doesn't have that same appeal, and I'm not like, oh, tense, and it's just not there. And okay, now that being said, when I shoot ringside, which I don't do much anymore, and it was a show this past summer, opening day of the Cyclones, and it was a show in New Jersey. And I ran out of there, Cyclone game in Brooklyn, to go to the house show in Meadowlands to shoot ringside. And as I'm shooting this, I said to myself, now I realize why I like this, because I'm taking action. People are around me, and there's just something going on. I'm watching this whole match unfold, and it was just intense. It was really good. And it wasn't that it was a great match. It was just the whole atmosphere of it. Because these days, I'm just taking pictures of baseball. Yeah, okay, I do baseball for the Cyclones, as you know. Many people don't know that. I've been a photographer there from 2001, from the first day. But I'll do red carpet events and movie premieres, concerts. So it doesn't have that same appeal. I'm just shooting. And that's why I said, oh, this is why I used to like this. I used to like the running around, trying to get the different angle and trying to move and jump and get what I got to get. So, yes, it's, go back to the original question, it's a lot easier. Do I like it? Yes, in that I don't have to go crazy about it, but I wouldn't like it if I was doing a magazine. And I continue doing it for the next who knows how many years, because I'm just sitting there. I'm just sitting there.
Now, you've taken thousands of photos over the course of your career. Many of those hundreds of thousands of shots, and many of them are iconic. We talked about the Andre photo a little bit earlier on. Of them all, and I know this may be an impossible question to answer, or maybe not, but I'm going to ask it anyway, do you have an all-time favorite shot? I mean, in the introduction to the book, you talk about how the book is essentially a collection of your favorite images, even if they're not all necessarily your best shots, but is there that one shot that stands out above the rest?
Honestly, no. That one shot is that one shot at that moment. As I'm talking to you, a picture comes in my head. At that moment, I needed Superstar Graham choking Dusty Rhodes with the Texas bull rope. That was my favorite shot at that moment, because I needed that picture at that moment.
Right.
Hulk Hogan playing air guitar with his belt inscribed with the NWO with Roddy Piper on the floor. Favorite at that moment, because yes, that's what it showed at that moment. But is there anyone that stands out? Not really, because I've done so many, and I used to put every magazine was 100 to 125, 150 photos, every magazine, and 90s, 80s, late 80s, 90s, four or five of those a month, which means 60 magazines a year, times 150 photos. It's so to say what was, it's impossible.
It all kind of blends together.
Yes, and that's why I said the Andre picture was probably the most, it was what it was, because it was the only one of its kind, and still to this day, you still would see when people show Andre, there was a documentary Andre a week or two ago, and yes, there's Andre, they show you that picture, and then you'll see a picture of Andre holding up a little baby, who's my son, in that picture, and the video of Andre, and then in the Andre video, you see the picture, I think I do have it in the book, in Japan, we're eating in Japan with Hulk Hogan and who knows how many other people, and that's in the Andre documentary that was just on. At that time, those were my favorites.
The title of the book is Hot Shots and High Spots, George Napolitano's Amazing Pictorial History of Wrestling's Greatest Star. That's a mouthful, you know that?
Yeah.
You've actually had several books. Your last one was published, about 10 years ago or so?
Yeah, in the 90s. Had to be 10 years ago, and I believe this would make number 12. I think I've had 11, and I only say that because then I went back and counted when I did the introduction to this book. I went back, and I always said I did 8. Well, there was 11. I didn't even I really didn't even know exactly. I never really kept count. You know, all I know is that I was always on a deadline. I was always doing magazines. And I just didn't do the pictures. I used to write all the stories, just about every story in a magazine, and I would take just about every picture, and I would get some pictures from other people if they were in Milwaukee, Mike Allen and a couple other people at different times. And my son, who was, depending on what era, he was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, would also take different pictures from me if I wasn't at the event.
Now, you already know this. I absolutely love this book. I was blown away by a lot of the photos that are in it. You've got legends. You've got Bruno Sammartino, you mentioned. You've got Fred Blassie, all the way through the NWO and DX and The Rock and John mm-hmm. Cena and Randy Orton. You have a TNA section in there. But you've also got plenty of candid, never-before-seen shots. There's several of the Road Warriors and the Steiner brothers who would often stop by to attend your son's games and practices. There's Mil Máscaras, Mask and All, in your living room holding your son. They really come across as being part of your family. Is that how you felt?
Yeah, and I used to be friendly. I mean, really, really friendly, because I used to see them all the time. It was just something that wasn't that somebody I would see on occasion. There were shows all the time. There were shows 2, 3, 4 times a week I would go. I would see these people. They became friendly, I mean, and friends, because I was just with these people all the time. And I used to go somewhere. I used to travel, and they used to pick me up at the airport. Or I would take a cab, and then they would drive me. I mean, they were just friendly and became part of, say, my family. And Hawk used to want my son to call him Uncle Hawk. I mean, he was at my house all the time. I mean, really, he was probably the closest Uncle Hawk, and Bushwhacker Luke. That was another really, really close, who I still talk to this day. One of the few that I talk to, say, religiously, once a week for sure. I talk to Bushwhacker Luke all the time, you know. And he's still around wrestling.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think I saw him about a year or two ago at a Ring of Honor show.
Yeah, he's still around, and he does Canada and wherever, and he lives in Puerto Rico, and he travels everywhere. He's still wrestling. People don't know that. But, yeah, but these were friends, and friends that I would see. I mean, I would see these people, honestly, some I would see them more than I see my family. See them all the time. And if there was a show in Brooklyn, my wife would know the dates, and they would eat either before the show or after the show at my house, come and eat. My wife would cook Italian meal, and they would come into the house and eat. They would look forward to having a home-cooked meal after being on the road all the time. They were on the road all the time, you know. And a lot of times, the show being in Brooklyn, by 10:15, they would come, and my wife would be cooking macaroni and at 10 o'clock at night and then getting up in the morning. I mean, they would be eating at my house, because a lot of times before the show, if they were rushed, it just didn't work, because you can't be eating a big meal before the show. They would just eat something light. So a lot of times it was after the show. And then the next day, if they were still in town, Hawk went to my wife's class. He would, you know, would just go in. And he would talk to the kids. They came to my son's baseball practice in the afternoon, the honky-tonk man. I didn't even mention him. He came to my baseball practice, little league practice, a couple times.
You got to tell me that if there was a bad call during your son's game, you got to tell me that Honky Tonk Man would take the guitar and smash it over the umpire's head.
Yeah, he would. And there was one day during the Cyclone game, not this past year, some kid came up to me, old as me now, came up to me and says, "I remember you were my coach." I didn't remember. I didn't remember the name. He says, "The best time I ever had was when the Honky Tonk Man came to our practice, and he signed their gloves and stuff." I mean, this happened this year, and this, somebody mentioned it this year happened, but that happened, my son was 29, 30, he was 12 maybe. So you're talking 18, 20 years ago.
But did he sing his song? Did Honky sing his song?
He would always break out of tune. It would break out. And then I have a picture of Hawk at a football. He came to the football game. And there's a picture in the book and that too. And there was a guy who stopped me at the Cyclone game and says, I remember you brought Hawk to our football game, and I told the man, I said to him, that picture's going to be in my book, I told him. And he says, oh, yeah, you still got it? I said, yeah. I said, which one was your son? And he told me, I don't remember. But I told this fellow, who's not a wrestling fan anymore, but just remembered that Hawk came to the football game.
Now, some of the more interesting photos I think people will enjoy in this book are those of a young Triple H, who he's now the heir apparent to the throne in WWE back when he was first breaking into the business as a student of the late Killer Kowalski. You had taken pictures of him at a high school gym, I believe, in Connecticut, and
it
was something that he never forgot that.
Yeah, and a short while after that, he went to WCW, and he saw me in WCW, and he says, he was a wrestling fan, so he knew of me. He knew of me because he was a wrestling fan. Saw me at the WCW. He says, come in. And he put his arms around me, and he thanked me for putting a picture. Again, it goes back to the magazine, putting a picture of him in the magazine, full-page color photo, because at the time he resembled a Ric Flair, so I put a full-page color picture. Nobody knew who he was. But to him, it was a big deal because he might have sent that to someone to make people know that he was around, and they would use that to try to get jobs. And he thanked me for putting the picture. And to this day, if he sees me, he'll yell, he'll wave to me, he'll call me, and he'll ask me. He says, "Is there anything I can do for you? Hey, everything okay? How you going? I need anything." He'll ask me if I need anything. And not because he's in charge or because he knows I don't really do much, but just because he was a fan, and that's what he liked.
And I think things turned out pretty well for him.
No, I would say so. I would say so. He again, talk about somebody who worked at it. He worked at his craft to get good and to rise to where he is.
Speaking of working at one's craft, like a lot of people, I grew up a big Macho Man Randy Savage fan, and I can't tell you how many Macho Man fans listen to this show. Far too many to count. Sadly, he passed away in May, and in the book, and I think you mentioned this earlier in the interview, you have in here the very first photo of Savage that you ever took, which was prior to a TV taping in Philadelphia when he was still going by his real name of Randy Poffo. And the thing that strikes me, he looks like a completely different person if you look at him in this picture. It's just amazing to see the transformation from what he was then to what he would become later on.
Yeah, well, he was a skinny kid who was a catcher in the Cardinal organization. He was a baseball player. And
now, was that picture taken while he was still playing baseball? Or
yes.
He was?
He was still playing baseball. And it was the off-season, so it had to be the winter time, off-season. And then he sent me an 8x10 of him with his, I think he was ambidextrous. He can throw with both hands. And he sent me a baseball photo of him with gloves on two hands. But nobody knew who he was, so I would occasionally put his picture, and he would then after it didn't happen for as a baseball player, he started a promotion. His father started a promotion in, I want to say, Lexington, Kentucky. And they had this promotion in Kentucky. And I would occasionally write stories about this Kentucky promotion based on photos that were sent to me actually by Elizabeth, his wife, became his wife, who he married after already being married, but he married her in the garden. There's a picture in the book that I believe at a SummerSlam they got married, but they had already been married. And she would send photos to me of Randy and anyone else who was wrestling at that time in the promotion in Kentucky.
Pat Patterson driving the taxi cab in Japan. You have to explain this one to me.
They were just wanted different pictures, and I just happened to see it. And if you look closely, Pat Patterson is not driving the taxi cab. If you look closely, past Pat Patterson is the steering wheel. Steering wheels are on the other side of the... are not on... Okay? So, yes, it looks like he's driving because he was in the driver's seat of what would be a cab, but the steering wheel is next to him. I was in the cab next to him with Andre, and we were driving, taking a cab to the arena. usually take a bus. We were taking a cab that moment. And it just looked funny, him in the cab, looking like he was driving it. That's why he took it, looking like he was driving the cab, when in fact he was a passenger in the cab.
Now I'm disappointed. I thought there was going to be a backstory behind why he was driving the cab, maybe making a getaway or something.
Yeah, no, there was a getaway I mentioned in there. I believe we were in Trinidad. I made a getaway with Abdullah and a couple other people, which I mentioned in that book.
Now, it's not your traditional wrestling book filled with long stories and a few color inserts in the middle. I mean, the photos really tell the story here. Really, I think for anyone who is a fan of wrestling history, whether you grew up in the days of the territories or if you grew up during the Attitude Era, you're pretty much going to enjoy this book, right?
Yeah, I would think so. It just presents itself as a collection of photos. And again, you didn't mention it, and it was mentioned earlier. They were not definitely the best. They probably are among the best. But I have taken hundreds, thousands. So whatever you see here, there are more and more and more pictures like that. You know, I didn't just say, "Oh, this is great. I need this." I went and grabbed a whole lot of stuff and sent a lot of stuff to the company, book company, and they weeded. And they picked out what they wanted, you know. That being said, I can't even give you a number of how many more. I have at least from this batch, there's at least 400 more that just weren't used.
Not to count
the other hundreds of thousands more.
I take it then we're going to see book number 13 at some point.
If they want to, we'll see. I mean, I'm not doing anything right now. I don't have a plan. I can tell you I'm working on it. Yeah, well, everybody's working on something. No, I'm just working on what I got to do tonight. I'm taking pictures of Jay-Z. That's my next thing. That's what I'm doing tonight.
Interesting. Well, again, the book, it's called Hot Shots and High Spots, George Napolitano's Amazing Pictorial History of Wrestling's Greatest Stars. It's available right now on Amazon.com. You can go to BarnesandNoble.com and really any place that sells books. You're pretty much going to be able to find it. And am I to assume that you will be keeping your streak alive and you're going to be at the Garden for the Survivor Series next month?
I'm hoping to be there. I'm hoping to be there in November.
Well, you are. We may bump into each other there.
Okay. Looking forward to it.
Well, George, it was great to finally get you on here. I really appreciate you doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you. Thank you very much and for taking your time. And there are many more stories where they came from.
Oh, I'm sure there are. And thanks, everybody, for listening. As always, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week for another episode of the Solomonster Sounds Off right here on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is John from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the Internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.